bad. Now the boat won't float, I don't like it. I'm too proud to be born. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working. We're just not working anymore. They used to call us working class, but we're just.
Welcome to the November 28th, 2009 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WEFT 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast worldwide at live at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Okay, and here's Tom with some acknowledgments of some of our underwriters.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Building coalitions amongst workers, unions, and the community, the Illinois Education Association and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice are proud to support WEFT Community Radio in East Central Illinois. This hour of programming is also brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, BMWE, celebrates the voice of for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for for us, and later in the hour, this week's edition of the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's brand new poem for this week, first here on Labor Hour, is entitled The Philanthropist. Also here with us today is co-host Bob Plesney, our technical expert and advisor, who has some news and banner for us. And also we have another member of our Labor Hour Collective and co-founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, Bill Gorell. So on with the show.
According to Illinois' Department of Employment Security, unemployment rates rose in 9 of 11 counties in east central Illinois in October. Ford and Payette counties were the only two to experience drops in unemployment. Ford County's rate dropped to 9.9%, down from 10.4% in September, while Payette County's rate dipped to 8.1%, down from 8.2% in the previous month. Unemployment rates were up in Champaign County at 8.5%, up from 8.2% in September. An estimated 9,236 residents were out of work and looking for jobs in October, while 99,549 were actually holding jobs. A year ago, in October of 2008, Champaign County's unemployment rate was only 6%. Of the 12 metropolitan areas in Illinois, Champaign-Urbana had the third lowest unemployment rate, while Danville had the fourth highest rate. Of the 102 counties in Illinois, 9 of them had rates of 13% and higher, while 8 of them had rates of less than 8%. The highest county rates were 15.9% in Winnebago, followed by 15% in Franklin, and 14.9% in Mason County. The lowest county rates were 4.5% in Brown, followed by 7.1% in Schuyler and 7.3% in Cass.
Okay, I've got a story from earlier this week. Irish government employees are staging the biggest strike in at least three decades, with about 250,000 workers protesting against plans to cut pay to contain the budget deficit. Nurses, teachers, and tax officials are among those taking part in the 24-hour nationwide stoppage over what labor unions have said are vicious cost-cutting plans by the government. Union officials have threatened further strikes if talks with the government on an alternative savings plan fail. Ireland, once Europe's most dynamic economy, has been hit by a property crash and the global recession, eroding tax income and pushing the shortfall to 26 billion euros. France Finance Minister Brian Linehan wants to cut about €4 billion from spending in the December 9th budget to rebuild investors' confidence after borrowing costs soared. And Ireland has already raised taxes and imposed a levy on public workers as it grapples with the deficit amounting to about 12% of gross domestic product. The stoppage had been partially scaled back due to flooding in the south and west of the country after heavy rainfall. Hospitals and emergency service workers maintain services in those areas. The strike did close social welfare offices, passport offices, and public offices of the state tax authorities.
Okay, I just got a little interesting some statistics here on health care. The U.S. is ranked 37th. That's 37th by the World Health Organization for providing the most comprehensive health care. And it's real interesting to see what the other who the 36 other countries are that are ahead of the United States in providing health care for their citizens. France is number one, followed by Italy. But here's some of the surprising ones. Number three is San Marino, a very small country in Europe. Likewise, Andorra, another very small country. Malta, an island nation, also pretty small. Another surprising one is Oman. And then we go down the list, of course, the ones that are to be expected. Austria at number 9, Japan number 10, followed by Norway, Portugal. It keeps going. And here's some more surprising ones. Coming in at number 22, you're not going to believe this, Colombia. Mm-hmm. Colombia, number 22 in providing health care. And then we go down the list. Another surprising one is United Arab Emirates, followed by Israel and Morocco. Morocco. Yeah. Okay, going down the list, Chile, Dominica, and then the country that is just ahead of the United States, right before it, is Costa Rica. So, yeah. You know, it's amazing. I mean, some of these small countries, especially many of those on there, well, maybe some aren't so small, but they're definitely don't have the gross domestic product or the per capita income of the United States, and yet they're able to provide better health care to their citizens.
They don't spend on an expeditionary army either.
An imperialist occupation army, yes, indeed. Or tax breaks to billionaires either. So, okay, Tom?
Hey, in a hopeful sign for the economy, the number of newly laid off workers filing claims for unemployment benefits fell below 500,000 for the first time since January. Consumer spending also picked up in October, and new home sales hit their highest point in more than a year. Combined, the news suggested that the economy should be able to sustain at least a modest rebound, where some economists were worried that the economy was at risk of sinking deeper into recession. The number of people filing first-time claims for unemployment aid fell by 35,000 to some 466,000, according to the U.S. Labor Department. That was the fewest since September 2008, and it was far better than the 500,000 economists had been expecting. Still, analysts noted that the jobless claims would have to drop to around 400,000 for several weeks in a row to signal an actual growth in available employment.
Harley-Davidson Incorporated and union negotiators in Pennsylvania have reached agreement on a deal that would slash jobs at the York, Pennsylvania factory, but that could keep the factory open instead of moving its work to Kentucky. Under the agreement, Harley would reduce the size of its workforce in Pennsylvania while investing $90 million in the York factory. The agreement was presented to Harley's Pennsylvania workers Friday and posted on the website of the York Daily Record. The company has been weighing whether to close the factory, which Harley says is inefficient, and build a new factory in Shelbyville, Kentucky. The proposed agreement would result in a smaller and more flexible workforce, and that really corresponds to the scale and scope of a restructured operation there, Harley-Davidson spokesman Bob Klein said Friday. Harley said last month that it would shut the York factory unless workers agreed to work rule changes that would make the facility more efficient. And members of Local 175 of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers will vote on the proposed contract on December 2nd, union negotiator Paul Cover Jr. said. We support the agreement because it keeps jobs in the area. Dave?
Okay, I think I'm going to pass to Bill. Do you have anything of interest to say or any news stories?
Well, I'm a resident of Piatt County who is unemployed, so I guess that low unemployment rate out there, what was it, 8-point-something?
Yeah, well, I guess that doesn't help your pain any here.
Meanwhile, people are driving from Champaign to build the swimming pool in Monticello.
Oh, yeah. That's the building trades for you, unfortunately.
That was 8.1%, Bill.
8.1%, okay. All right. Okay, I want to let everyone know that here at about half past the hour, we're going to be having some students call in from L.A. There's been a lot going on out in California here in the last couple of weeks with the student strikes and building occupations and everything. It's been quite dramatic. So at night from 11:30 to 11:45 our time, we're going to be having some students call in from Los Angeles, which has been a hotbed of activity. And then at 11:45 to 12 noon, we're going to be having students from the San Francisco Bay Area call in, primarily from Berkeley, telling us what's been going on there. So we're really looking forward to this.
Hey, Deere & Company Incorporated of Moline, Illinois, reports that sales of their tractors and combines and other agricultural mainstays slumped in the fourth quarter, and the company is expecting farmers to remain cautious about purchasing any new equipment in the near future because of the weak global economy. The company ended fiscal 2009 with a profit of almost $874 million, but lost $223 million in the fourth quarter due to charges related in part to pension costs and job cuts. Deere laid off hundreds of workers earlier this year and actually closed the Canadian factory. Deere is the biggest U.S. manufacturer of farm equipment, and sluggish economic conditions in the U.S. and much of the rest of the world continue to drive down the demand for tractors and the company's other agricultural equipment. Farm prices, although historically high, have dropped sharply from the bubble highs of the last couple of years and have driven down farm incomes by what the U.S. Department of Agriculture projects will be 34.5% by the end of the year. Unless figures miraculously balance, a lot of laid-off brother and sister workers at Deere & Company are going to remain laid off for a while.
Okay, I got a story here. And this is, with Thanksgiving here, many of us reflect on what we're most thankful for. Most people's answers range from my loving family to having good friends or being employed in this downturn economy. One person who didn't make the cut onto any of our lists Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis, the 2009 poster boy for big bank greed. As the head of the financial giant, Lewis led the bank down its failed course of reckless lending practices, platinum bonuses, and blatant disregard for workers in our economy that helped drive the financial meltdown. Seeing as how the end of Lewis's profit-driven reign as chief executive is finally in sight, SEIU 32BJ members have decided it's high time to recognize Mr. Lewis with a Turkey of the Year award. Bank of America security officers will deliver a frozen turkey to the ousted chairman of the board for his role in allowing the bank's security contractor to fire some 40 security officers working at B of A buildings in New York City right before the holidays. Another 130 officers who are still employed there lost their family health coverage. The affected workers, officers were originally employed by Securitas Security and worked at four Merrill Lynch locations in New York City. That is, until Bank of America took over Merrill Lynch. Around this time, B of A refused cost of living raises to its lowest wage workers and then pink slipped Securitas, a responsible contractor. The frozen turkey the security officers affected by the bank's layoffs and benefit cuts will deliver to Ken Lewis will be wrapped up in a Turkey of the Year sash and presented to the ex-CEO on a silver platter.
As Bill Gorell said in a previous program, these guys got to go to jail. I mean, this is just, they shouldn't be running the country, that's for sure.
Well, I mean, yeah, you go ahead and you ruin millions of people's lives, man. I was going along pretty good. I had a plan. You know, I was going to be out of debt and have my full pension in 8 years. Now I'm a year behind, you know, and I'm deeper in debt, man. I'm willing to work, but they wrecked everything.
Yeah.
You know, why do they get bonuses? Why do they get jobs in the government running things? Why do they send me stuff telling me they're screwing around with my credit? You know, after they got me sucked in with easy offers for years and years and years to inflate their bubble.
Goldman Sachs has given out $17 billion in bonuses this year.
That's $17
billion? $17 billion in bonuses. You know, this is ridiculous.
You know, we had a friend of ours call us from Florida who's lived down there for 9 years. She's from Champaign, and she just had her house foreclosed and had to leave. And her house was valued a few years ago at $189,000. It sold on auction for $42,000, and then the guy wanted that won the auction wanted the key from her immediately, and she said no way. And he goes, and then he even found out where she had moved to a couple days later, came to her house and said, I'm trying to remember what day I bought your house, because I've bought so many of these lately, and I want the key. You have to give me the key. I'm the owner now. And she basically, you know, told him, well, I can't say it on the air, but slammed the door in his face. But I mean, it's these vultures and parasites. It's just unbelievable. But that's just that's American capitalism for you. So okay, we're gonna go a little workers independent news, and then we'll be right back with Tom Thomas's poem of the week.
The San Francisco Labor Council is calling for a comprehensive labor-led campaign for economic recovery, including a big national jobs march in Washington, D.C. this coming spring. In a resolution adopted this week, the Labor Council also called for an end to wars and military occupations, affordable health care, housing for all, a sharp increase in corporate taxes, and full funding for public education and social services. The San Francisco Labor Council resolution says working people are continuing to suffer growing unemployment and spreading home foreclosures. The resolution calls on the AFL-CIO and the Change to Win labor federations to mobilize a massive number of people to march in Washington in the spring. The San Francisco Labor Council wants the march to demand ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and redirecting that money toward jobs in a peacetime economy. This march, the resolution says, should be just a part of a strategic campaign for an economic recovery plan for working people. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the Employee Free Choice Act, labor law reform making it easier for workers to join unions free of employer intimidation, remains a top labor priority. He says it's essential to a true economic recovery for workers because it would give them the power to bargain for higher wages.
So this is all about making any job a good job through collective bargaining.
Yeah.
Even though it has cut 2,000 jobs this year, Yahoo is still moving forward with plans to build a 48-acre campus that could house nearly 12,000 workers in Santa Clara, California. According to the Silicon Valley Mercury News, the company released a draft environmental impact report on Tuesday. The development would allow the company to consolidate existing leased space while providing room for future growth. Yahoo currently employs more than 13,000 workers and is currently headquartered in Sunnyvale, California.
A proposal to extend a contract for Ohio University workers was rejected this week. The skilled trade and service employees are represented by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. The current contract is set to expire March 1st. Following the rejection, the university said it will begin contract negotiations next month.
Here is today's economic report. Wondering how your coworker managed to get all of that holiday shopping done so early? It's likely they did it while on the clock. According to a new survey by CareerBuilders.com, 32% of workers plan to get some shopping done online and while at work. That's up from 29% in 2008. 5% of employers surveyed have fired a worker for online shopping.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day to help keep labor's voice on the air.
Okay, we are now at that point in the program, the Illinois World Labor Hour Cultural Corner, Tom Thomas's poem of the week, The Philanthropist.
You saw someone you worked with once, not all that many years before, and he was begging on the street. He lost his job and became poor. There was a time he was working for 40 hours every week. He bought his food and paid his rent in times that were not quite as bleak. A piteous lone figure. He needed a coat to buff the wind and maybe some new socks and shoes so against the cold he could fend. More to be pitied than censured, that beggar once had a great job until the Republicans came and drove him to the jobless mob. Now he is among the hungry who are homeless and who are poor. He tried to find another job, yet could not find an open door. Some say we are recovering from our economic defeat, but those who are saying the words are not they who are on the street. You gave him a couple of bucks, though he did not remember you, but from the way he shook your hand, you knew his gratitude was true. The Philanthropist was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on November 26, 2009, Thanksgiving Day, and was first recited live November 28, 2009 on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. We have some public service announcements here. Got a real interesting event coming up this week, which is Thursday, December 3rd, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Don Moyers Boys and Girls Club at 201 East Park Street in Champaign. It's Freeway Rick Ross with a hip-hop detox in the pain. This event is designed to reach the youth and help them cope with the social and emotional ills of the society. It is also an opportunity for Freeway Rick Ross to use his story and fame as an American gangster to challenge dealers to keep their entrepreneurial spirits but change their products. Rick Ross was a pawn in the Iran-Contra scandal. He was supplied with kilos of pure cocaine by the CIA's frontman, Blandon, and when Ross paid what he owed the money was used to buy weapons for the Contras to fight the Sandinistas. He has reported that he was the sole cause for supplying the Crips and the Bloods with crack and flooding the streets of L.A. The crime rate, violence, the mandatory minimums, broken families, etc., are all a direct result of the crack epidemic that started in the mid-1980s. And this is our chance to really understand what this phenomenon has been. There was a chance to talk about how this all black males have been vilified in the media due to this epidemic, and this is where Hip Hop Detox comes in. And in conjunction with Aaron Ammons and Dr. Patterson, is a presentation, community dialogue, and will not be a panel discussion. And again, that's Thursday, December 3rd, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Don Moyers Boys and Girls Club, 201 East Park Street in Champaign. And also to let everybody know, tomorrow, Sunday, and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m., Labor's View TV on Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6. Tomorrow's episode will be about the socialist-run government in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, from 1912 until 1960. So a little bit of history I guarantee you never learned in high school unless maybe you lived in Milwaukee. So tune in for that. That's hosted by myself and fellow worker Jim Iman. And we've got some, there's a video presentation from Milwaukee Public Television. television that we're showing too, as well as talking about some of our historical knowledge and some of Jim Eyman's own personal experiences. He knew the last socialist mayor personally in Milwaukee, Frank Zeidler. So anyway, tune in for that. Now we're going to go to a little bit of music. This is from the GEO montage, thanks to Bob Polesny at the rally outside the Swanloon Administration Building a couple weeks ago during the graduate employee strike here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. So we're going to play a little of that, and then about half past the hour, we're going to be getting some calls from some student strikers on the West Coast. So I hope you enjoy this.
Chicago Tribune this morning, and she told me that the administration has claimed that it's business as usual on campus.
Hell no! Shady! Shady!
If they haven't gotten the message yet, they're getting it now. Will never be business as usual on this campus if our tuition waivers are not guaranteed. It will never be business as usual on this campus as long as the administration does not fulfill its obligation to ensure accessibility to public higher education for all. Be business as usual on this campus as long as the administration acquiesces to underfunding at the state level and moves towards corporatization and privatization of our public university system.
Somewhere between prayer and revolution, between Jesus and Huey P. Newton.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, this is Julia Wallace. I'm calling from Los Angeles.
Well, welcome to the show, Julia. Glad, just a pleasure to have you here. And so I guess you've been having quite a dramatic couple of weeks out there in Los Angeles and the Bay Area. Could you tell us a little about what's been going on?
Yeah, so there's been a statewide movement against the tuition increases and against the layoffs in particular. And this kind of culminated on November 17th, but especially on the 18th and 19th, when students rushed the building at UCLA and occupied buildings all over the state. And then on the 19th, when the Regents voted for a 32% increase in tuition, and the students took siege of the building and basically surrounded all the exits, and when the Regents tried to leave, surrounded them, including other members such as Karen Bass, and basically refused to allow them to just walk out while they're preventing so many people from going to school and laying a lot of other people off. So it's been exciting for me.
Wow, that's pretty dramatic. You know, we had a graduate student strike here back on, let's see, it started, Bill, refresh me, it started actually...
we went on strike on the 16th.
The 16th, Monday the 16th.
Right.
But they were actually able to resolve things within 2 days. At the end of the second day, the university, our equivalent of your regents, the Board of Trustees, I guess, approved their contract and everything. But yeah, it's, you know, out there, I mean, it seems like the stakes are a lot higher, and it sounds like the powers that be are a little bit more intransient. I mean, I understand that I was reading some of the email dispatches that there was actually not your traditional pickets, but actually locked arm pickets to prevent people from actually physically enter the building at one point.
Yeah, there were a myriad of different tactics that were used, and it was just so exciting to see the resistance of students, a lot of whom, this is their first protest, this is their first interaction with police brutality, because the police did become extremely brutal, in particular to African-American men, but they were brutal to all groups, all races, all genders. And so it's the beginning, you know, it's the beginning of their increase on our tuition, on our standard of living. It's the beginning of their assault, and it's the beginning of a resistance on behalf of the students, and hopefully soon more so on behalf of the workers.
Well, yes, that's a good point. Have the students been getting any help from the organized labor in any way?
Well, there have been some help in terms of, like, a lot of assistance. I know at Berkeley, the UP T and Q went on strike for those 2 days. In Los Angeles, they did not. There was a lot of support in terms of food and buses. They asked me to pay for buses to come down. So there's been a lot of auxiliary support, but one of the things I would say is that the union really needs to be a central part of this fight back. You know, if we think about the AFSCME strike that happened 2 years ago, they were able to shut down campuses, you know, by the workers being involved and by the students playing a role. And I think for the next fight backs that we have, the unions are going to have to be central. They're going to have to be part of this fight, and not just play an auxiliary role, which was important, but also to play a leadership role in just stopping these things from happening, including stopping the regents meeting from happening.
Well, yes, I would, you know, definitely agree this would be in their best interest. I mean, not only will these, you know, various corporate assaults on our universities, besides just denying access, it's eventually, and they have come after the workers' salaries and benefits, but also all these workers have children that might want to go to the university, and it's just going to become more and more difficult, if not impossible, for that to happen for working-class children. Bill, you had a suggestion that, in what Julia was saying, of how the unions could play a more decisive role instead of just being as a logistical backup.
Well, I think that right now the building trades unions ought to go to Springfield and occupy the Capitol and get those people to institute a progressive income tax.
Okay, that's in Illinois, but would you recommend that in California for them to go to Sacramento?
Oh, sorry. Yes, I think with the building trades, they don't want to embarrass the Democrats is the big deal. And you know, and I'm sick of it, man. We need Obamavilles out in front of the White House.
I agree. I mean, look, like this, the unions are central to this fight. They could have shut down that building, even if it was just a few workers that cut the lights and gummed up the locks. They could have stopped it. And if we're talking about what's happened, hundreds of students have been arrested all across the state. And so if students are getting arrested and, you know, doing those kind of militant actions, what are the unions have to respond in kind. That has to happen. You know, I think AFSCME has a no sympathy clause where they can't go on strike. That's going to have to be challenged. And the rank and file are going to have to lead that charge to challenge it, because, you know, he's right. The Democrats are trying to make, you know, deals with them, and let's see if we can get one furlough day and this and that. And we can't do that. They have the money. We can't accept that they have no money. That's been the biggest fall, I think, in terms of this fight, the setback, is that if we accept that they don't have the money and that there really isn't trillions of dollars that the banks have and trillions of dollars in the war, if we accept that, then we're accepting that there has to be layoffs, and I don't accept that. I don't think we need. I don't think we should accept that. So, you know, we need to get our money back.
Yeah. Speaking of how funds are allocated, we have a listener named Neil Parthen, who, by the way, has a sports show. Him and Matthew Damien on. I guess we could call it our sister station, WRFU, low powered.
Yeah,
station.
Independent media, indie media, low power FM station. Yes.
Yeah, it's coming on at 2 p.m. on 104.5, I believe. Mm-hmm. If you live within a few blocks of there. but anyway,
they stream on the internet too.
Okay.
WRFU.
Okay.
But getting back to this, Neil asks to ask about how the UC system was giving loans to the athletic department while at the same time saying they didn't have the money to keep libraries open and so on and so forth.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. There's all kinds of ways to divide the movement. I mean, I think that there has been privately a lot of money that's been put into athletic programs. You know, you could even argue a lot of working class people get into college through athletic programs. But to me, I'm fine with athletes getting money, okay? I think everybody should have an education. And that this would come out is an interesting notion, because then you say, well, maybe the athletic students don't deserve this amount of money. Maybe these people should get this money or whatever. But really, you know, that's fighting over crumbs when this whole economy has money. There is money. And instead of us focusing on the athletic students, I'm focusing on the regents and what they're doing, what they're trying to do, and really just privatizing education. That's what they're trying to do. This country can afford to provide universal education. Cuba can. So,
yeah.
You know, they can afford it. So I'm not buying that one at all. I think we have to stand with athletes and all students alike and say everybody should have a free education.
Yeah, I think, Bill, I think what he was implying was that it seems like wherever there's a will, there's a way to come up with the money needed. And I think that was just a point by Neil, who we know pretty well, to show that, you know, that seems to be a big priority of, you know, like, well, we live in a college town here, and we know that our athletic association, it never lacks, you know.
Yeah.
And so I don't, you know, I understand your point, too, though, and I think you're absolutely right that we do need to be focused on more of the corporate structure of the universities, which is becoming, you know, has just increased exponentially in these last several years and decades, and the privatization aspect. And it's all part of, unfortunately, corporate America and capitalism in general trying to deny our rights for our public universities to, you know, all students.
Yeah, for example, here at the University of Illinois, one of the large construction jobs that went away last fall with most all construction jobs here was adding these ugly, ugly skyboxes to the stadium here so that they could sell them to the corporate people and the rich people and just suck up more to the wealthy.
Yeah. But back to what's been going on in L.A., Julia, I understand that how long did the building occupations last, and how many buildings was there occupied in L.A.?
In L.A., there were two at UCLA, mm-hmm. and then there were several attempts at occupying on Wednesday at Cal State LA,
okay.
and people tried to get into the Board of Trustees, which is for the Cal State universities.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to get into that meeting as well on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just been attempts. I mean, the movement's really new, you know, and again, a lot of people didn't expect the way the police were acting, you know, tasering people left and right.
Oh, no kidding.
Wow. Pepper spraying, choking them, you know, and the people that they were choking, some of these people were just regular college students. You know, as a black woman, you know, working class black woman, I am not shocked at police brutality.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the people who were at these events, it was obvious it was their first kind of intense feeling, you know, of what can happen when you cross that line. They're okay with you going to class and being quiet and stuff, but once you start, you know, stopping the bus, because that's what we did. There was a bus that the police got two regents in, so 100 people surrounded the bus.
Oh,
wouldn't let them leave.
What an image.
And that's when they choked this one guy, and they thought it was going to scare people.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, it just made him more furious and more determined not to leave.
Good. Yeah, I remember in the, you know, 60s and 70s that police brutality, or say National Guard people shooting four students at Kent State, tended to radicalize people more than scare them off.
You know, yeah. Julia, you mentioned that a lot of the people there, besides this is the first time I've seen police brutality, but you were saying, too, that in one of your emails about how the type of students that were there on the picket lines participating were not the type of students you normally see at such events, that they basically it's sort of like a whole new layer of the student population has sort of been, how should I say, their eyes opened and have decided to take action.
Yeah, I mean, there were people who had on their UCLA jerseys who just came from practice with their cleats on.
Oh, okay.
Had picket signs who coming from, and then other people who were saying, come on, man, let's leave practice and let's go. Mm-hmm. So you had a few of these athletes coming in with, you know, just joining the protest, especially after the vote was passed. It seemed like on Wednesday there was a real militant push to get inside the building, and the police weren't aware. They didn't have their helmets on, so they were getting hit with water bottles and all kinds of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, and then on, wow. And then after that happened, there was a group of people that kind of tried to be a buffer between the police and the crowd, which I don't know who those people were, but I think that played a kind of a dissipating role.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But anyway, after the vote was passed, people just, it was almost automatic. Thousands of people surrounded the building, hundreds at each parking lot entrance. When Karen Bass left the building, 100 people swarmed her and said, shame on you, you coward, you corporate bastard, and were attacking her.
Mm-hmm.
She's a Democrat.
Yeah, well,
but she voted for the budget cuts. I mean, that's what, you know, that,
yes.
No one was exempt. Didn't matter if you were a Democrat or Republican, because it, the truth is, it really doesn't matter, because both of them voted for the budget.
Oh, indeed. In the end, they always seem to circle the wagons together.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to protecting, you know, corporate power and privilege. Okay, well, listen, I know, of course, a lot's happened. Of course, a little bit's calmed down now because of the Thanksgiving holidays. What have you been hearing through the grapevine about what's going to happen next?
Well, there's going to be a meeting December 5th at the UCLA Labor Center at 1 o'clock. For people who are interested in answering that question,
mm-hmm.
there are still some meetings that, you know, senators are going to be trying to have, and I think we should take a similar approach to them as we did to the regents. You know, now is kind of the bureaucracy's cleanup, you know, to apologize and say, well, we voted for it, but we didn't really mean it, or whatever, and to really start calling these people to task, and start finding out where, you know, what they're doing, and approaching them wherever they are, political or non-political, and just not giving them any peace. You know, this budget cut isn't giving people peace. So there's that meeting on December 5th at 1 o'clock at the UCLA Labor Center, which is across the street from MacArthur Park.
Mm-hmm.
There's also going to be a larger action in March 4th, and that's the plan for a day without education. And so what a lot of us are really trying to do, to my organization, Labor's Militant Voice, what we're trying to do is to help organize the whole educational system. That's parents, teachers, K-12, CSU, community college, and the UCs, and to really just stop the system, you know, to not allow them to just continue to railroad our future.
General strike.
Yeah, that sounds like quite a broad-based industrialized type of organizing. I think it's great. I think it's definitely a great plan what needs to be done. Okay, Julie, well, thanks for calling in. We're going to be hearing from some of your comrades up in San Francisco Bay Area here in just a moment. And I just want to mention, you mentioned Labor's Militant Voice. I'd just like all the listeners to know that Labor's Militant Voice comes out with a newsletter pretty much once a month, and I highly recommend it. It's a great newsletter called Facts for Working People.
Oh, by the way, are there any websites or anything people should pay attention to?
Yeah, well, our blog that we write on, and we welcome other people to write and subscribe on, is www.weknowwhatsup.blogspot.com. So that's We Know What's Up, because we do know what's up, .blogspot.com. And, you know, I also invite people to join the October 24th Coordinating Committee. If you search October 24th committee, you should be able to find, and more of the comrades up north can talk about that, joining up on our listserv to really participate in organizing and strategizing. You know, it's not limited to anyone except people who want to fight against the budget cuts. This is for workers, it's for students, you know, we all have the same fight, you know, that's what that is. So check it out. Thank you so much for having me on your radio program.
Oh, our pleasure. Thank you for calling in, Julia.
Venceremos.
Stand up. We shall not be moved except by a child with no socks and shoes. If you got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up and I'll copy you. Stand up. We shall not be moved except by a woman dying from a loss of food. If you've got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up and I'll copy you. We still don't understand. Thunder and lightning flash back to when we didn't fund the dam. Didn't fund the dam levy. No wonder, man.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, hello, this is Luis.
Yes, Luis.
We got a lot of forces incorporated because we had a strike from the 18th and then the 19th, and on the 20th we escalated. As I'm sure you know, there was an occupation of Wheeler Hall, which is one of the bigger halls on campus. And I think that the really amazing thing about the mobilization on the 20th was that we're able, even after 2 days of striking, to be able to actually build up our forces and occupy a building where we had over about 1,000, you know, to 1,500 people outside the building, occupying the building in a mass democratic way.
Okay.
I think in that sense, it was pretty phenomenal to see so many new kids getting involved, seeing freshmen that weren't involved before taking up leadership roles, and just seeing how a union strike led to all these other issues being put on the table and saying, like, look, education as a whole is being privatized, and a lot of different sectors on school came together, and from there we've continued to hold General Assembly's planning for the future, building towards March 4th, which was a statewide call that came out of a statewide conference after September 24th, where over 800 activists from unions and over 100 schools representing K-12, community colleges to the UCs, ended up deciding that to call for a statewide day of strike and action on March 4th. So these strikes that we just built on for November 18th and the 20th were specifically to build up to a day where we can actually have a strike that literally shuts down the entire campus with masses of students and masses of workers. So it wasn't like it was just an isolated fight, like it was November 18th to the 20th, but it was like we're building up towards something. And I think that was what's really important, that it happened beyond the UCs, and that was happening, for example, in San Francisco City College. There was protests. There was protests at San Francisco State. There was solidarity protests in San Jose. There was, you know, it's beginning to spread beyond the UC, and I think it's part of the reason why, for example, we've been able to keep up the protests at Berkeley. That we know that we're part of a much bigger movement, that we're building towards the united goal, which is March 4th.
Okay. Now I heard it even spread down to Santa Cruz. Is that correct?
Yes, Santa Cruz had their occupations as well. They had the strike as well from the 18th to the 19th. UC Davis also had massive protests and also ended with an occupation where they actually got the administration to sit down with them and write a statement. So they were pretty successful in some of the things that they did in Davis. But yeah, it's spreading. It was in Santa Cruz. It was in, I mean, various schools. We've been getting a lot of different updates through the internet.
Okay. Now, we just talked to Julia down in Los Angeles, and she was saying that there was a really repressive police response, police tasering people, choking people, you know, pepper spraying and stuff. How did the police react up in your area?
Yeah, at Berkeley in particular, the force was just, I mean, it was overwhelming for a lot of students. There was a lot of students that just, I mean, they were getting involved for the first time, that just seeing, you know, full-geared riot police with batons, with guns, with tasers, marching towards huge group of students. It was pretty frightening for a lot of freshman kids. A lot of people got beat up.
Mm-hmm.
They came in. First, they called the Alameda County Police. First, UCPD was there,
mm-hmm.
and we made it clear that it was a peaceful protest, and we made it clear what we were fighting for. And the administration, in particular the chancellor and the provost, decided to call in the riot police, and at that point we understood that they weren't a reliable partner anymore. We understood that, look, if the administration was really on our side, why would they call in the riot police? I mean, the riot police, you know, really what they come in to do, I mean, is to break things up. And
to break people up, and, you know, as far as breaking their bones. I mean, they've definitely overreacted, but they're going to pay the price for it, because history shows that when this sort of thing happens, it doesn't scare people, it just strengthens their resolve. And I know Julia was telling us that's kind of what happened down in Los Angeles, too, and everything. So what's the next step, then, in your area? I know Julia said that they have a conference coming up here December 5th down in L.A. Do you have something, sort of a follow-up coming up here next week?
Yes, yeah, so, after just the repression of kids getting beat up with batons, like, you know, kids got shot with rubber bullets, there was tear gas used. I mean, and the thing is that there was a lot of freshman kids that got beat up, and that, you know, they just came in breaking up the mass movement outside. They got into the building that way. So one of the things that we did to follow that up was that we protested. We went, first there were three kids that got arrested, so we went to Oakland, where court was being held, and then we visited the President Udall's office in Oakland,
mm-hmm.
and demanded to meet up with him. So that was a follow-up action there, and then we had a vigil at Berkeley, you know, outside the police station.
Okay.
You know, condemning what had done there. But yes, what we're building up now is also December 5th, which is a Northern California regional meeting to coordinate efforts, you know, with Southern California, who's also going to be heading their conference, and with Central Valley, who's also going to be having a conference.
Okay.
And this is part of, you know, making sure that we're on the same page and just, one, being able to coordinate with our actions, but at the same time being able to build towards March 4th, which is what the conference is about. How do we move on from here? We've had huge demonstrations. How do we come back during the spring semester and we hit the ground running and make sure that we continue to build on what we built on this last semester, which has been pretty significant what we've done, I think.
Yes, and you know, this just to remind everybody, this was a totally peaceful protest picket, and just goes to show you who the police really serve and protect, and it's definitely not the working class. Listen, Luis, thank you so much for calling in. We're about ready to run out of time, but keep up the fight, because you're fighting for all of us out there. I mean, it's just good to hear that a lot of a whole layer of the student population that have never had any kind of experience like this before has finally had their eyes opened as to just how far the system's willing to go to protect its wealth and privilege. So thank you so much for calling in, and keep up the fight.
Of course, thank you so much.
You bet. Take care.
Okay, bye.
Okay, Dave, I got a few comments here off of Facebook from a couple of listeners. Kendall Welch, who, by the way, is one of my more conservative friends there, and Neil Parthen. And Kendall, we had the comment from the previous interview on, say, the Ask Me people gumming up locks and cutting power.
Yeah.
He says those are legitimate arrestable. He asks if those are legitimate arrestable misdemeanors. Yeah, they would be, and that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
As the Wobblies used to do, you know, fill the jails.
Well, when the law doesn't work, when the law doesn't carry out justice, and when the law only serves the interests of the ruling class, what is a worker supposed to do? Are they supposed to let the system starve them into submission? I mean, that's just the whole point. When the laws don't work for the people, then there are no laws.
Yeah, well, it's civil disobedience anyway. Let me see. He has a comment. Kendall also has another comment. When money is given to the university, that money, parentheses, especially athletic, is given for a specific purpose, as mentioned, often for athletic programs, cannot be used for anything else. And he would point out that every hall that is named for a person had money donated by them or by their family for that purpose. I don't know that apparently they did something, gave money to the athletic department, or loaned money to them. I believe that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now Neil Parthen comes up. The donations weren't for scholarships because
sports scholarship. Yeah, they were not for sports scholarships.
As she was talking about, but they were discretionary funds for the athletic department.
Discretionary funds are usually kind of a slush fund. I mean, they do everything from giving raises to certain administrators to...
You either spend it on what you want or stick it in your pocket.
Yeah, that's the case around here, too, in the past.
He also points out that in 2007, the university regents forgave $31 million in loans to the athletic department. I thought athletic departments were profitable. You know, okay. Let me see. We got... okay, Neil's addressing Kendall here, saying, Kendall, a lot of money from universities isn't private donations going to the AD, athletic department. Most universities rely on fees, debt service, discretionary funds from the university leadership to help subsidize their existence, as well as the private donations to their AD programs. Let me see. I got it. I just got another notification, and I don't know where it went.
Okay, this is great with this feedback. Bill's been bringing his laptop here, and we got instant feedback from a lot of our listeners, which is really good.
And by the way, folks, if you want to participate in it, go to Facebook, search for Bill Gorrell, that's G-O-R-R-E-L-L, and send me a friend request. And also remind people that they can find out more at weknowwhatsupblogspot.com. And do a search for the October 24th committee.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Bill. And we're about running out of time. We're June to next week for another edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour. And we're going to leave you with a little music that I thought might be appropriate to considering the subject matter today, Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
Yeah.